I heartily endorse this event or product.
Ahoy hoy everybody, welcome to the latest episode of Talk to the Audience, where this is always death. I am your host, Bob Mackey, and who's here with me today?
Dane, still in the glow of Dana Gould, Henry Gilbert.
Oh yes, I have that Gould magic on me, and it won't come off.
Glow.
Yeah. Won't even come off in the shower. So if you're new, there are lots of people who are new to the Patreon this month because of stuff that happened. And I want to say welcome.
Welcome!
Yes, we do a monthly community podcast where we read comments and we talk about news, both in the world of Simpsons and what's going on with us. And we have a lot going on right now because we just met a ton of goals and we're going to launch maybe two new series right now.
Yeah, you're going to get more podcasts coming soon. And also this is... we're recording in between our two live shows as well. Like, we have just been hitting success after success.
It's been really great.
January has been a really good month for us.
And January is supposed to suck, but we're making the best of it. So, yeah, let's talk about what's happening with our Patreon. So, number one, Talking Futurama is coming. You folks voted for it. You didn't vote for King of the Hill like I told you to, but I still want to do Futurama, so thank you so much. As we said before, we are not doing all of Futurama. We are doing one season, and then we're moving on to the next miniseries. That's so we don't alienate people who don't want us to wait, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 years before we get through all 10 seasons. It's probably like 4 or 5 years. I forget how much Comedy Central Futurama there is.
There are 10 volumes of DVDs, like, and they did that many. I think some people maybe misunderstood how long we're going to be doing the show and that it's one season versus all of it. I actually had to explain to Chris twice that we're like, no, we're not doing.
Yes.
He was just like, man, you guys are starring Futurama. You should really do Mission Hill first. I'm like, it's one season. We're not doing the whole thing yet now. Like, we'll see where the other votes go in future voting. But
And as with Talking Critic, we'll do a number of episodes of that, and then we'll take a break and then move on to our next miniseries. I don't want to be doing 3 podcasts a week perpetually forever. It's nice to have little breaks built in to do things like plan live shows and other things like that. We're very busy, but we appreciate all your money, and we love that we met these goals. So yes.
So, well, last thing I'll say about Futurama is thanks everybody who voted. We only got about 670 votes, which is less than half of people. Maybe next time we'll have the thing go for a whole week instead of
it's probably a good
weekend.
Idea. Yeah.
But also, though, I had a feeling Futurama was going to win.
Oh, me too.
After our Christmas, a holiday podcast thing, and it won.
It was somewhat close. I think King of the Hill was maybe like 10% below Futurama.
Yeah,
I really
wanted to do Pretty Pretty Dresses.
Yes.
The day will come.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
And yeah, if you want to watch along and prepare for this, like, I just rebought a copy of Volume 1 of Futurama, which that's how we're doing it. We're not going with the aired Season 1 of Futurama, which was like 8 episodes or something. We're going with what is production Season 1 / what's on Volume 1 of the DVDs.
And I think that ends with the Titanic episode. That's the last one of production Season 1.
I love when Farnsworth shakes his head at the idea that someone could live through going through a black hole.
Yes.
That's pretty great.
Also, everyone had to do a Titanic episode in 1998 or 99. It was law. TV law.
I do believe on the Hulu is also every episode of Futurama, including the first season. So if you want to watch along that way, you can do it as well.
I want to write an angry letter to Hulu, and I want them to list all of their seasons by production order. I hate all of these, like, Futurama has 20 seasons or something. That's not what the actually is there, but it's not what I know as Futurama. So we also hit our $8,000 goal, which is amazing. So that's going to unlock a new weekly series that will be free to everybody. Are we doing advanced episodes of this too?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought so.
We'll be following the talking... We don't have a name for it yet.
Yeah.
We will be following the Talking Simpsons model of a free podcast that you can subscribe to if you're not a patron, but patrons will get it a week early and ad free. And it'll be on a different day of the week than Talking Simpsons, and the format will be the Talking Simpsons format, but it lets us play around and do any series one episode anytime we want of an animated product.
Yeah, and without having to vote ourselves to a season of it. Just like, I want to do this one episode I really like because we probably won't do this entire series. Yeah.
Now, I mean, I would love to do a Talking Simpsons of every episode of Steven Universe, but that day might not come.
Yes.
But I at least want to do select episodes of that show, or Like, I've been watching a ton of the JoJo's Bizarre Adventure anime. Uh-huh. Maybe I'd want to do something like that. This is not a guarantee.
It's hard to do fighting anime because like things happen and you need more than one episode to talk about, but I guess you can cover an arc or something. Yeah. But yeah, we want to do anime, so we don't know a lot about the show. We don't know the name. We don't know if it's going to go on a different feed or put it in the Talking Simpsons feed. I don't know that yet, but we're going to be planning a lot of this. We worked pretty far ahead on Talking Simpsons. We recorded, we can tell them, I think the last one we recorded was Lisa the Vegetarian. So
yeah,
we have,
we're three episodes ahead of ourselves right now, four episodes ahead of ourselves on the free feed. So mm-hmm. we've given ourselves a couple weeks to really work on that stuff.
Yes, and that includes things that we're working on, includes the Patreon. So the top tier patrons get their own podcast made for them off, and sometimes we'll be recording with them.
Yes.
So that will actually, we're going to work that into the new series. Mm-hmm. So some of the episodes will have guests either choosing the topic or sitting in with us mm-hmm. on that podcast.
Yeah. So we're sorry for the delay on that to our top tier folks out there. We really appreciate your big monetary support of us.
Like, I don't think anybody complained. I think they all trust us. At least I hope so. So this, hang in there. And if you're still donating at those levels, you'll be unlocking another custom podcast soon. So that's coming up soon as well. And last thing I want to talk about is our live show, which you will hear a week from today. Mm-hmm. And we can give away what happened on that, right?
We tell the behind the scenes. It out, yes. And it was a public event so people can know what happened.
Break the embargo.
And again, this is before our live show on the 28th, which so the history on this is really weird a little bit to explain, because in November, we found out we were going to get to do a live show January 28th, mm-hmm. and we were advertising, like, our first live show ever, come on down, and we're super excited about doing that. Then on January 4th, we got an email from Cole Stratton.
While you were in Japan.
While I was in Japan. I took a vacation to Japan, by the way, folks, in between these episodes. It was really fun. It was all about wrestling, and I won't bore you with wrestling talk.
That'll be on Laser Time this Monday, I believe.
Yeah. But so
bonus time, sorry.
So anyway, though, while I'm in Japan, we get an email from Cole Stratton. He's just like, we have an opening on a January 18th show. Do you guys want to come? And hey, maybe I could even get Dana Gould to pop in.
Mm-hmm.
And I pretty much freaked out. I woke up to that in Japan. You got to see it at like 2.
We couldn't say no to that.
Absolutely not. So we ended up doing 10 days before our first live show. We did our first live show.
It was pretty amazing too, because for our first live show, there was a lot that was up in the air until the second it actually started. So we planned 45 minutes of material for the live show, which you'll hear. Mm-hmm. You'll hear an hour of that. We planned 45 minutes because we assumed Dana Gould might do 15 with us. Mm-hmm. Maybe 30 seconds before it starts, the audience is full. We're sitting there. We're told he'll be there for 35. So it's like immediately we have to re-engineer this to be a Dana Gould-focused podcast. And we did a great interview with him.
I think
we did extremely well for, keeping on our toes, because we did not expect to get to talk to Dana Gould for that long. So we talk about things like his work on the show, being on The Simpsons during 9/11, things like that. And, putting his daughter into the show. So it was a great chat, and he was very nice.
Extremely nice.
Yeah, yes. I was kind of worried. I'm like, I don't know. Dana Gould seems like he's a little grumpy based on what I hear on podcasts. And he'd probably say that too. He'd probably agree with me. But I think he's one of those people where he's been in entertainment for like 35 years, but he's still happy when someone recognizes him, because he's not like Tom Cruise or whatever. He's like a comedy nerd celebrity. Like us.
Yes, to all the comedy
we're nothing
nerds,
compared to him,
he
though.
Is a star. And yeah, he was there. He was there to help advertise. He was doing his own panel before ours about his new show, Stand Against Evil, though I wouldn't even call it new anymore. It's like 2 years old.
Yeah, it's great, though.
It's a really great show. Obviously, you're not watching it on IFC, because who watches IFC? But it's on Hulu and totally worth watching.
It's early access on IFC.
Yes, yeah.
And then they patch out all the bugs and put it on Hulu.
And yeah, I've always been a big fan of Dana Gould. I remember watching his stand-up in the early 90s. Like, I didn't tell him a thing I told Emo Phillips once when I met him, which, like, I've been watching you since I was in middle school, because they don't want to feel that old. But
I've been with Dana Gould since the Gex age.
Yeah.
I resisted making a Gex reference because I didn't know how he would react, but then I found out that was a happy time for him.
He loves remembering Gex and him and Rob Cohen working on
it. Writing a million one-liners.
I just remember, I think the first time I can remember seeing Dana Gould and knowing it was Dana Gould, because I did play Gex before this but didn't know who he was. I remember him and Gex saying, like, like, oh, Scoob, let's go back to the mystery van in one of the scary levels of Gex. But I remember his bit about how he wish he had a voice that would tell him when he was making a mistake. And he'd be like, oh, I can do this. Mistake, mistake.
And that was in Gex?
No, that wasn't a stand-up. I remember seeing on the Comedy Central. Like a loser, I saw it on Comedy Central. But
I found that quite unusual.
But he was super friendly. Like, we met him right beforehand.
Yeah, thanks to Henry for being the one who approached him, because we were all looking at each other like, I don't want to bug the famous person who agreed to work with us.
But I felt it was good to say hello to him beforehand, because I think it warmed him up, too, that he didn't just, like, sit down next to us. And that's when he met us
as strangers.
Talk.
So,
and he had a funny thing of saying, we thanked him for doing it. He's like, oh, yes, it's very, he's paraphrasing. He said, oh, yes, it's very hard to convince me to talk about myself. Like, oh, I hate
Yeah, he told
it.
Some great stories, some I hadn't really heard before. So, and I'm sure it was all new to the audience.
And he would have talked for a whole hour, I think, at least, he had to immediately leave to go stand up. And that was too, like, I was so nervous the whole day. And
me
then,
too.
Then to think that he was like, oh, yeah, I'll do a panel and then just talk on some dude's podcast and then immediately do stand-up, just walk away and do it. But
he's a busy guy.
He's a pro, man.
I mean after we found out we got him for 35 minutes, I was sort of having an out-of-body experience after I introduced him. I'm like, oh great, I get to listen to Dana Gould. And I was like, no, Bob, you're also hosting this too, so you have to ask questions and stuff. I'm like, oh shit. So I thought it turned out really well, and I think to our credit, I think we did a really good job of rolling with the punches and kind of re-engineering the show, and then doing all of our material after that.
Yeah, I think the Dana Gould list half was also really good. I think we did a good job. I guess they'll be able to judge for themselves, but the audience in person liked it.
Yeah, we got lots of laughs.
Yeah, and it was also awesome to have, I don't know, all our friends were in the front row. Like, that was really...
To psych us out.
They were there to support us. It felt really cool to have friends there supporting us.
And it wasn't just our friends too. When the whole thing started, I asked who has heard of our show. Most people hadn't.
Yeah.
And most people stayed. So that was great. I mean, the rest of the stuff was boring science crap, so who cares?
I also felt good seeing that, like, I don't think really any people peeled off when Dana Gould left, thinking like, oh, we got to see Dana Gould somewhere else. Like, I'm done. Or I heard Dana Gould, I don't need to hear these dorks.
Dana Gould is kind of our warm up act. That's not throwing him under the bus, but he got the audience into the into the spirit, I think.
Yeah, and he revealed some cool stories, and he was super nice to us, and like, Chris even showed him where the like green room was, if you could call it that.
Yeah,
it's
kind of a confusing layout if you have not been to that museum before. Yeah.
Oh, also, we have nowhere else to tell this story, but we mistook the green room as like, no, that's not the green room. I bet there's a real fancy room with a bunch of free food. So then we go to what looks, we're like, oh, this is this fancy room with free food, and we're just going to eat food.
Yeah.
Within 20 seconds of being there, we were given the, may I ask, would you please leave without a fuss right now?
Yes, it's like, you're not fancy enough to be here. Yeah, the green room was basically the utility room, where we're comedians in the utility room.
And there was pizza there.
The pizza was kind of picked over by the time I got there, but it was fine.
But I wish we missed out on it. Chris and I got to chat a little bit with Cole Stratton and try to act this is normal for us. We're normal. Like, and compliment him on Riff Tracks and how cool he is with that. And didn't get to meet Janet Varney, who was there. Did not. Same with Chris had to point out to me, or might have been you, point out to me later. That
was Chris.
In the green room was the actress who plays Stan's daughter on Stan Against Evil, and she is so fucking funny on the show.
She's great. I don't think I was in there when she was.
None of us were in there. I walked by when she was in there.
No, she's great on that show.
But I didn't recognize her because I did this stupid, like, TV watcher thing of thinking, like, well, she must look like her character all the time. Like, she's not an actress. She looks like her character all the time. Like, no, but she is so funny. Anyway, man, what a fun night at the museum, at the science museum, doing it under inside of a giant globe.
It was
very strange.
We neglected to mention it was inside of a museum, and it was not in a room. It was sort of just out in the open, and that made me worry, because I've done live shows in that environment. I'm like, oh, the sound is going to be bad, and no one will be able to hear us, but it went really well, and I'm happy, and you're going to hear it in a week. So we should get into the comments. We have a lot. We did so much between the last talk to the audience and this one. So I had to be extra selective in choosing questions and comments. So please don't be offended if I didn't choose yours. We did a lot of stuff over the holidays. So yes, it was. This was really hard to do. So let's start with Round Springfield. Zachary Adams says, the story behind New Coke is pretty fascinating. Pepsi was touting their Pepsi Challenge taste test, where people were picking Coca-Cola when they thought they could see the labels, but picking Pepsi in a blind test. Pepsi was gaining in market share, though Coke had an overwhelming lead, and so Coke's executives decided to reformulate to something sweeter and with less of a bite to give the people what they seemed to be saying they wanted. It backfired badly, of course, because people want brand familiarity more than anything else, and Coca-Cola had to backpedal, though Coca-Cola Classic isn't quite the old recipe since that was when they switched to the high fructose corn syrup instead of cane sugar. I know Henry does not enjoy Sody Pop. No. It hurts his teeth.
It hurts my teeth.
It's too cold, but I will say Coke is superior to Pepsi. I love the kind of gingery bite it has to it. I hate Pepsi, just like pure like sugar water. You can feel your teeth dissolving in it. I'm a Coke man.
I also feel it's a very American thing of like, well, no, I bought the bottle. When I see this logo, I taste what I taste.
It's like a placebo effect kind of deal, yeah.
Is that when you eat bees?
That's right.
I try to make a Simpsons reference whenever I can. My brain goes to it. It's just like, especially now, I got to be on brand.
I'm cured. I mean, ouch.
Daniel Feit, who I hung out with in Japan and was a super cool dude, though I'd seen him before. Hey, Dan. Said, I'm with you on calling out some of the poor jokes in this episode, but I think you're too harsh on the story concept of Lisa dealing with a personal loss. Sure, Murphy was a safe choice, and the show telegraphs his death with every trope, but I can't think of another cartoon show at the time that would kill a recurring character and then show how that affected a child. No matter how many years it had been since Lisa canonically saw Murphy, his sudden death would have hit her very hard. I'm still reeling from the unexpected death of a friend in 2016. I hadn't seen him in a while since I moved out of the U.S., but I was devastated by the news. Lisa being a kid and Murphy being her one-time idol means that no matter how long it had been, his death would have impacted to turn a big way. And that's true. In continuity, I wasn't particularly fair to Lisa, being like, she wouldn't care he died. Like, she would care that he died. But yeah, my big problem with that episode is just the behind the scenes stuff, how tropey it is, how openly they were like, well, yeah, we're going to win an award. This is for an award show. Like,
yeah, I think that taints it, knowing the context in which it was written. Also, I feel like in isolation, the scenes with Lisa being sad are fine. They work well. But within the context of the episode, I feel like they did not earn those moments. They did not work their way to those moments. Like in something like Lisa's Substitute, I feel like they lay all the right groundwork so those moments hit you a lot harder and feel more real. But in this one, it just like it feels like it's dropped into an episode where everything around it is just so different.
Yeah.
So yes, I appreciate the difference in opinion, though. So Ian Richmond says, while hating the French always bugged me as a Scottish person, hating the French is a much more of an English thing. Historically, Scotland and France had an official alliance which was essentially built on mutual hatred of England. It's technically still in effect some 800 years later. It's known as the Old Alliance in Scotland and is always mentioned whenever we play France in a football or rugby match.
That's pretty cool. I liked hearing from a true Scotsman like Ian Richmond.
It's
about
maybe
Willie.
Less to do with Willie being Scottish and more of him being xenophobic and hateful.
Yes, yeah. I think of this as a new Simpsons joke, even though it was probably over a decade ago. But the joke of Willie saying like, he hates that person like a Scotsman hates the English, and a Scotsman hates the French, and now the Scots hate the Scots. They ruin Scotland. Skinner says, "Boy, you Scotch people really hold grudges. You just made an enemy for life."
See, there are good jokes coming up.
Yes.
Okay. So, oh yeah, you're next.
Yes. So now we're going on to the, we're hitting the beat of Springfield Connection. And Matthew Hardaway said, we had a DARE officer at my elementary school who was arrested for dealing drugs. Then it was decided to make DARE part of the health class that was required in high school. The teacher of that class got a DUI on a riding lawnmower. They did not do a good job.
Yes, the war on drugs. Excellent work, America. Yeah. You did a great job.
Boy, DARE, what a joke. And I think wasn't there news recently they want to bring it back and reinstate it?
It's Jeff Sessions, right?
Yeah.
He is still obsessed with stamping out the demon weed of the Orient, mm-hmm. marijuana.
He's kind of a monster.
He really is.
He's a monster among monsters. I guess really the current administration is like the Legion of Doom or whatever, where it's just like, who's to say if Brainiac is worse than Luther? But them working together is pretty bad.
I mean, it's good that these monsters are given ridiculous bodies so we can mock them. It's like Jeff Sessions is an elf. And Mitch McConnell is a turtle, and it all works out. And
he's an icky elf.
And Donald Trump is either Wario or Robotnik, or a mix of the two.
I also like hearing that he's a Grimace, an orange Grimace.
Grimace. All right, so Kiefer Folsom says, so rewatching this episode, I noticed a reference. I can't remember if you mentioned it, but during the montage of Marge at the training academy, specifically the obstacle course, I think this might be a reference to the opening of Silence of the Lambs. And I will say definitely a visual reference because it opens with Jodie Foster training, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And the same like white t-shirt and everything too. So
it was her training, and it was an early reference to how she is treated as a woman in the world of law enforcement, which is an absolute theme of the episode of Springfield Connection as well.
If that was a critic joke, Hannibal Lecter would be there.
He would have
fava
like,
beans.
Yeah, he would have gone like, nice jump, Marge.
and sipping Chianti.
There were so many times, if we ever get to interview Al Jean, I want to tell him like, could you have been just a little more subtle? Like, it didn't have to literally be Hannibal Lecter showing up and then having Jay's father say, oh, cousin Hannibal, of like, he could have been anybody.
They were really worried about people not getting jokes on The Critic.
Yeah, that's
they needed more confidence.
It's kind of a thing Al Jean talked about in the Simpsons movie on the commentary, saying they would never reference a movie that nobody had heard of or that they couldn't count on the entire audience of hearing of. That's why, like, oh, we'll do a Titanic reference, but they cut out a reference to Cartopia from the movie.
You know what? He should have watched Troy McClure's video. Get confident, stupid.
Joe Hodgson says, Magic Eye is something I haven't had to think about for 20 years. I was never good at being able to see those things, but apparently I never told anyone. I remember one day I came home from somewhere and my grandma was over and she excitedly told me that she had bought me something and it was in my room. Thinking of a shiny new toy was waiting for me, I ran into the room to find a framed Power Rangers Magic Eye had been hung on my wall.
No.
I was hopefully convincing with my lie that I thought it was great and was happy to have it. That thing hung on my wall for years, and I never was able to see the image that it contained.
Oh, boy. I think on that episode, I even said, I can't do magic eyes. I still can't. Maybe my vision is too good. I don't know. But I remember in that, 6-month period where every comic book had a Mallrats ad in it.
Oh, my God.
Was the magic eye picture. I don't know. I think it just said Mallrats.
Right.
I think it was just the Mallrats logo, and it taunted me. I'm like, I can't do this, and all my friends can do it.
Just like Ethan Suplee, you were tainted.
It's a schooner.
Yes, yeah. Though you didn't turn to Scientology like Ethan did.
No. Don't watch Mallrats again, folks. It's my warning to you all.
Keep it in your memory.
Yes. You don't want to see Jeremy London act again.
Oof.
There's a reason why you can't do that anymore. Mm-hmm. These are Lemon of Troy comments. So this is part of a longer conversation. I clipped out this one comment because I thought it was great. Chris Dobson says, I always got that Kirk and Luann were their own doppelgangers from the two towns, Shelbyville and Springfield.
Holy shit.
Just like Moe and Joe are.
Wow.
So like everybody has their own doppelganger. So Luann is Kirk's female doppelganger from Shelbyville.
Man, I never thought of it like that. That's perfect. It's the same as if Willie dated the groundskeeper of Shelbyville Elementary.
Oh, yeah. I forgot. There is the female Willie there. Okay, mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, so this is a good fan theory.
It totally fits.
It involves no one being dead the whole time, so we're good.
It is not that not all doppelgangers are the same gender or even the same race in the case of the Asian man who runs the Quickie Mart or the Speedy Mart, I believe it was.
Speedy Mart. So Chris Dobson gets our version of the no prize.
Mm-hmm.
I think so.
That's a good one, Dobson. Daniel Fight Again returns. You brought up Stallone and Burgess Meredith when talking Rocky, so get this. When the first Rocky movie was released, Burgess was 69. Nice. He wrote that. I'm not saying it. In 2015, when Creed, a.k.a. Rocky 7, was released, Stallone was 69. Nice. Also, both were nominated for Best Supporting Actor in these films, but neither won.
Wow.
I would have liked Stallone. I was rooting for Stallone that year. I was like, just give him it as a thank you of just like before you give him his like,
you're gonna
you
die,
made it to 90,
Oscar,
we'll give you your honorary thing.
It's hard to believe that Stallone was, 71 in Guardians 2.
Yeah.
I mean, he is a mega millionaire and probably has had a lot of work done and he lives a fantastic lifestyle. But
his face is the plastic version of his face.
That's true.
He at some point, instead of just having touch-ups in facial surgeries. They grafted on a Stallone mask to his face.
He now looks more like Weird Al in UHF doing the parody of Rambo 3.
Oh, yeah.
So Nina C. says, "The choke the rivers with their dead line might be another reference to the Trojan War. In book 21 of the Iliad, the river Scamander objects to Achilles plugging him up with Trojan bodies. For the, quote, for the loveliness of my waters is crammed with corpses. I cannot find a channel to cast my waters into the bright sea, since I am congested with the dead men you kill so brutally," unquote. Achilles basically tells him to deal with it. Scamander replies by initiating a sweet man versus river mini boss battle. Achilles is outmatched and nearly drowns, but Hera and Hephaestus save him by producing a firestorm that boils Scamander until he surrenders. Wait, maybe that's what is happening in Cleveland. I knew pollution wasn't real, says Nina C. And yes, that is someone, that is a Harvard graduate joke. Did you get it? Mm-hmm. Did you get it?
Those, man, Achilles, I don't know the Iliad that well. I did not know Achilles fought a river.
That's pretty cool.
I didn't talk to him of just like, hey, putting corpses in this river. Fuck you, river. And then Achilles, being the loser he is, has to have fucking Hera and Hephaestus fight his battle for
him. Bail him out. Yeah. Tag him in.
Jacoba Genovese, forgive me if I misspoke that. He's writing to us talking about the Simpsons Italian dub being great. This episode is a prime example of that. When two Milhouses have their moment, the Italian translators make Springfield Milhouse say a proverb in Neapolitan dialect, which translates to, "Every cockroach is beautiful in his mother's eyes." I think this is a genius way to make Italian viewers relate even more to Milhouse in that scene and make the line extra funny and freaky. In fact, for whatever reasons, plenty of Simpsons characters are given accents from different Italian regions. Reverend Lovejoy is Sicilian, Wiggum is Neapolitan, and Carl, most hilariously maybe, is Venetian.
I associate most of those descriptors with pizza because I'm a dumb American, but that's really interesting.
We just ate fancy pizzas last
night. That was good, but that's...
I like that a lot. It also reminds me of a Saudi listener. He had pointed out to me, like, in this wrestling video that was dubbed over, he's like, these characters in wrestling who are supposed to be Southerners were given Egyptian dialect, like Egyptian dialect, to be like, no, they're Southerners. They're not Arabs.
God, if I had all the time in the world, I would explore like what they changed in the Japanese version of The Simpsons. Like, what is this idiomatic expression? What did they change that to in Japanese? What did they change this pop culture reference to in Japanese? Like, I want to know how they change everything, because you have to change so many things from The Simpsons,
I think,
to make it work.
That's what localization is in general. Like, I remember that in animes, the animes of my youth, but they would either have to completely change a joke to make it a modern reference, or you would need to read the liner notes of something like, say, Urusei Yatsura, that says, well, okay, so there was this baseball player in 1983 who did this thing. That's why Ataru says this.
It was the most kind of logical and academic way to do it, but it's kind of funny. It's like, if you want to get this joke, read these two paragraphs, and then you'll laugh.
Now it's funny.
Yes, get it? So we have Who Shot Mr. Burns Part 1. A lot of people pointing out great things about both these parts. Let's talk about them. So Bradley Winton says, another clue you miss is when Marge takes Grandpa's gun. She says she's burying it in the yard so little hands can't get to it. I don't think that choice of words is a coincidence and is a pretty well-hidden clue towards Maggie being the culprit. Yeah, I buy it.
I didn't think of that, but they seem to have thought of everything on that episode. So yeah, I think so. Jackie Beckwith brings up, it seems to me the main reason for Ned to call on Sideshow Mel at the meeting is to point out that he could be the S&M on the sundial. Similarly, Burns calling Smithers by his first name reminds you of those initials. Yeah, if they don't say Waylon in the episode, you wouldn't know WS unless you're a mega fanboy.
I mean, my theory is still the joke reason is because Ned wants to hear a classier threat to Mr. Burns, but the clue reason is to tell the viewer Sideshow Mel, SM, because you might not know who Sideshow Mel is. So Ryan Clark says, so I'm not sure if Hank, Bob, or Chris have ever noticed it, but when Mr. Burns mocks the town and asks if any of them can stop him in the shot of everybody averting their eyes, the only person still staring at him is Maggie. And yes, lots of people sent that gift to us, and you're right, and we think we missed it in the recording.
I did miss it in the recording. I didn't notice it until I made the gif of it for tweeting out the episode when it was on the Patreon, and somebody pointed out, like, hey, you notice Maggie doesn't look away? It's like, wow, yeah, everybody else does it, but you miss it. It's such a subtle clue.
It's two dots not moving amongst a crowd of dots moving.
And even better, your eye line is to look at the eyes of L of the Simpsons at normal height. Maggie is on the bottom of the screen. Like, I never even noticed in the 8 million times I watched the episode back then. I never even noticed Maggie's in that shot because your eye line is drawn to the entire audience. Okay, so Virtua Cat says, if this episode was made today, or conversely, the internet was accessible back then, was as accessible back then, do you think it would have been a foregone conclusion that Maggie was the killer? Would we have dozens of people on Something Awful or Reddit going over the entire episode searching for clues? Basically, do you think at this point in time something like this could be done in the future? Can any medium do a cliffhanger with clues and foreshadowing without it being ruined by the internet? I'd say no.
I want to agree with you and say no, but I think in recent years, shows like Breaking Bad, they were so cliffhanger reliant, and I'm actually surprised that maybe I just wasn't looking for the answers or looking for leaks, but I don't remember that ever being spoiled for people.
I don't think that one was, but there, or say Mad Men, but they have to, you have to operate with mega super duper secrecy, and it works better on shows like that are animated. I think that an animated show would have a better chance, but I think more so there's just more guessers now. So even if this happened and not everybody guessed Maggie, there would have been dozens there, and it could have caught fire and just everybody like, oh yeah, duh, it's Maggie. And it's something to, like, on Venture Brothers, I actually, last year at Sketchfest, Danny Gould hosted a Venture Brothers thing, and my question in the Q&A was, did they ever on Venture Brothers have to change something because somebody guessed the answer in between seasons? And they said, absolutely, because if you want to play fair, you have to give clues, but if you take too long, people are going to guess it, and then it's like, well, yeah, duh, it's this. And so then you have to move in the opposite direction of the obvious storytelling and just to swerve people and give them the surprise you wanted to, which I think it's better to have tell a better story in the end, even if people guessed it.
I think even 20 years ago, the movie Scream 2 was basically rewritten at the last minute because people found out who did it, what the mystery was. So even that long ago, this was hard to do. But I will say, speaking of TV, I was listening to the podcast I Was There Too, which is a great podcast, by the way. It's interviews with people who are like in the background of shots or playing extremely minor roles and things. But I forget who the actor was, but he played the character in Mad Men, which I've never seen, who gives the final speech to Mr. Madman, the character of the show.
Oh, yeah, that was Brett Gelman.
Yes.
The hilarious Brett Gelman.
That was Brett Gelman?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, he's in that episode. I don't know if he's the guy who
I don't think
the last
it's Brett Gelman.
Sorry,
it's,
you'd remember Brett Gelman.
It's, yeah, that. Definitely I remember if it was Brett Gelman, but it was just the character actor giving this really pivotal speech that people were mad about because he has like the biggest thing in the final episode. But he was talking about how the level of seriousness about his role. It's like, you will be sued into oblivion if you tell anyone you were on this program before it airs.
Wow.
Like, we will destroy you and your family. Like,
wow.
I'm exaggerating, of course, but they said they made it very clear that it would be over for me as an actor if I said anything to anybody about this. So.
They kind of have to make it clear on shows like that. It hurts shows like Game of Thrones because, look, I don't even watch that show, but I know it just through, like, cultural osmosis. And people guessed twists, but it's because they've had a decade to think about it. And it's like,
yeah,
well, then obviously, once you know how a storyteller works, people are people. Like, even the best writer is a writer who thinks in a certain way. And when you can figure out how they think, you might be able to figure out how they're going to end a story or where their next twist is going.
Yeah.
And there's been multiple twists in Game of Thrones that people figured out just through detective work.
I mean, many things can happen in mainstream fiction. It's harder to figure out what will happen in the third series of Twin Peaks than it is to figure out what will happen in Game of Thrones. Because
if you have a tropey show that's basically a soap opera with boobs and more blood, then it's kind of easy to see where it's going. Once you get over the shock value of like, oh, I think the rules are they won't kill this character, and then they kill that character, then you know, oh, they could kill anybody. Well, then I predict this. And another thing that doesn't help shows like Game of Thrones is their actors are so famous that when they start being cast in other stuff, this happened with Walking Dead as well, where they're like, oh, wait, they're cast on a new pilot. They wouldn't be doing that if they lived through this season. Like, so
they're dead.
When Jon Bernthal was cast on a new show, During season two of Walking Dead, where they're like, well, your character's dying. Like, and so then I wonder if they had to change like the rules on contracts to be like, you can't even take a new job until you've been killed on the air.
You can't get a new haircut until you,
yes, that's how people knew Jon Snow wasn't dead.
That's right.
They're like, well, he would have cut his hair. Nobody would keep that haircut unless they were being forced to.
But now that I know Brett Gelman is on Mad Men, I will watch it finally at some point.
You'll get to the final episode and see him in one scene.
It was all worth it. So Andrew Bouvier says, you guys asked why Burns dropped the weight on Homer's head instead of using his trapdoor. Well, it's because he obviously had to remove the trapdoor to make room for the giant model of Springfield under the floor. And wow. I replied to this and I said, in any other episode, that would have been a coincidence. But Oakley and Weinstein wrote this.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they had in mind, like, well, yeah, the trapdoor is gone because he built that model under the floor.
Yeah, I believe it. You know what? I believe that. So then we get to our Simpsons Season 6 wrap-up comments.
Yeah, so this is by Ted Komorowski, and it's a very long comment, but he's a great animation curator. He wrote the definitive book about Ren and Stimpy, Sick Little Monkeys. We will have him on to talk about Ren and Stimpy in our new series. So I included this very long comment because we're animation-obsessed, but I want to split this up. So, Henry, you take the first paragraph, and I'll take the second one.
Okay. This is tangential, but you mentioned a few topics that are dearer to me than The Simpsons. His first one is, as far as I know, Chuck Jones was never the victim of the overseas system, as he always had the luxury of doing animation in California. His drawing simply got that much worse, and the jazz between him and his best animators, Ken Harris, Ben Washman, Phil Monroe, Bobe Cannon, Abe Levitow, just couldn't be recaptured. There were some really talented guys working on later CJ productions, Eric Goldberg, Greg Duffel, Will Finn, of course, but sometimes you can't save garbage. Though his very last Roadrunner cartoon, Chariots of Fur, I always thought was excellent, largely because the young Disney hotshots working illegally on it got to use Chuck's 50s versions of the character rather than his horrid later versions.
That explains a lot.
Yeah, it looks so much better, and it was because, like, they didn't have to draw like Chuck Jones's degrading art looked, which is, I love Charles Schulz, love him so much. When you get older and you've been drawing your entire life, your art can suffer, and it doesn't make you a worse person or anything, or makes your work necessarily bad, but you don't draw the same as you did when you were 40 years younger.
Your body is just deteriorating, and there was a charm to like Charles Schulz, like wiggle pen art towards the end of his life. I'm not trying to be demeaning, but he did have like a tremor or something that caused his hand to shake like that. But Chuck Jones, I feel like, he figured out, it was not only just age, but he was like, he figured out like the cutesy stuff is what sold. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the Grinch is great, but then everything kind of looks like the Grinch after that period. It's like everyone's curly smiles and eyelashes and mugging and stuff like that. Yeah. So Tad continues. These are great comments by Tad, by the way. So he says, and I believe he went off on a tangent about like Chuck Jones and like the old Looney Tunes compilation movies. So the Warner Brothers cartoon compilation features, all of them, hold a special place in my heart and for a lot of people, because those were our introduction to those cartoons before the advent of every cartoon ever being made readily available. Daffy Duck's Quackbusters is probably the best because it was made by geeks Greg Ford and Terry Lennon and uses the Warner horror parodies to tell a coherent story. Also, yes, bag on the wildly varying quality of the bridging animation, but Quackbusters has some solid gold by way of Mark Kausler, who animated the bridging sequence for the footage from Porky and Daffy's Prize Pest. It's unnerving how Mark nailed the style of a 1951 Bob McKibben cartoon. Most anyone working in animation today wouldn't have survived a day at Warner's, save Mark. Yes, Quackbusters, I will say, I think it was the best just by having the best, what's the best selected cartoons, the most exciting ones. They're all horror based.
It was, instead of being based on director, they're like, no, let's get the horror ones, the scary ones together. Though it was also, I mean, this is again blaming an old man for being old, but it's like Mel Blanc was dying. Like he's
That's
dying
right.
And that, especially in the Mel Torme opener where Daffy like squirts stuff on his throat to sound like Mel Torme. I'm just like, you're a dying old man. Especially, I didn't even know as a kid like how old Mel Blanc was, or that he had like been in a horrible car accident at one point in his life. Like
he almost killed Barney Rubble.
Yeah,
Dawes Butler had to stand in for him for a few episodes.
It also drove me crazy seeing some of that stuff of just like that Mel Blanc's son thought he's like, I can inherit Bugs Bunny. He's like, you suck at Bugs Bunny.
Yeah,
you're trying to get cronyism into there. And but yeah, I do agree with Thad in that those do hold a special place in my heart just because as a kid, the Bugs Bunny and Roadrunner movie, Quackbusters, Daffy's Treasure Island, no, Daffy's Fantasy Island. Yeah.
Fantastic Island. It was a parody of Fantasy Island, the show we all remember.
Yes. But all of those, they weren't, I wouldn't revisit them now because there's other ways to watch them. But as a kid, those VHSs were the only way I could watch the classic Warner cartoons until they started re-airing on Nickelodeon and then later Cartoon Network or TNT. But those were so random, you could not really count on anything. If I got the Bugs and Roadrunner collection and rented that, I knew I was going to see Duck Season, Rabbit Season. I knew I was going to see the one with the bull. I knew I was going to see all my favorite Chuck Jones cartoons.
When I was renting those as a kid, especially Quackbusters, I enjoyed them, but there was always the pang of disappointment, like, oh, this is a clip show. Like, you can't do that. But then I would just enjoy seeing the bridging sequences because it was stuff I had never seen before in my life. So, new stuff. So, we're up next, Henry, for Who Shot Mr. Burns, Part 2.
Zachary Adams says, more context for Willie's confusion on the Space Invaders thing. In the 1967 sci-fi series The Invaders, the aliens hiding among us aren't able to move one finger for much of the series. So the hero asks people to make their bent finger gesture to verify their humanity before trusting them. I only got it as a kid because the Sci-Fi Channel, as it was known then, ran and reran it around the same time the episode aired, and it got remade the year after with Scott Bakula and Elizabeth Pena. So, man, yeah, I guess that does make more sense. The Space Invaders gave him that finger thing.
And that it was actually before the arcade game. So maybe the incorrect date was correct for the joke.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
So Turd Sampson says, another reference to Willie's fingers, a reference that slipped by you guys. Willie's alibi of having arthritis is a specific reference to the O.J. Simpson trial where O.J. claimed he had arthritis in his knees from playing football, which would have made running and climbing impossible for him. That is likely, it's probably both references they're doing.
Yeah, that's true. I bet O.J. Simpson invades so much of this episode. It's true.
Yeah.
That arthritis thing also reminds me of something that was revealed might have been revealed before, but I learned of it from the amazing O.J. Simpson Made in America documentary. That in the classic glove don't fit moment, people thought like, well, yeah, the glove doesn't fit because he's wearing a glove on top of that glove to put it on. But it was also that he intentionally, in the days before knowing he was going to put the glove on, did not take his arthritis medication, inflaming the joints in his hand, making his hand bigger so he couldn't put it on.
He sounds pretty innocent to me.
Yeah. Well, and, I mean, you got to give props to Johnny Cochran for thinking of that, man. Yeah. That was his job was to beat the police, and he did it.
I will say there are so many gems in that double murder case that the thing about the running and climbing was probably the one thing that was in the news at the time of the writing. And then it was like avalanche by the glove won't fit and everything else. So I'm sure that was like a standout moment when they were writing it.
You need to watch Made in America just to know how much, if you didn't live through the O.J. Simpson thing, and even I was like, I was a child at the time, but I still noticed it changed America. Like it for the worse in almost every way.
It really did.
Yeah. Howard said, it's interesting how you all mentioned that Skinner admitted he was going to ambush Mr. Burns. He said the very vague ambush, which did not indicate him intended to kill or even attack Monty, was an arrestable offense, but did not mention how Smithers drunkenly wielding and shooting a firearm at an innocent bystander is not. At the end of the episode, Smithers should be in prison. Yeah, even if Jasper doesn't want to press charges because apparently he doesn't remember, I think he should still be charged for that.
I mean,
reckless endangerment or something.
All law goes out the window at the end of part two, but I mean, Smithers is also guilty of sending a lynch mob after Homer, a death mob after Homer, putting a bounty on his head, but also very illegal. So yeah. Smithers, his hands are dirty.
Wiggum represents the law, and he is there for both of those things, and he's fine with it. And maybe Springfield has very clear stand your ground laws that just like it exonerates Smithers in that case too.
And basically, Wiggum frees Smithers after a brief chat with Sideshow Mel.
Yep,
there's no process in that. There's no legal process. He's like, oh, that clown sidekick told me he was innocent, so I'll believe
him. Melvin Van Horn is very he's very convincing.
He's one of the smartest men in Springfield. Up next, we have Shy Ranger, who says, so here's a question I had rewatching this. You guys sort of mentioned it. The 138th episode spectacular shows the fake animations done to throw people off, such as Barney, Apu, and even Santa's little helper shooting somehow. In fact, until the Sunblocker showed up to threaten everyone, I think he was one of the few people that Mr. Burns actually didn't do anything to. Just a random thought I had.
Yeah, I mean, everyone in town hates him for the Sunblocker, but right. They didn't make a scene of the Quickie Mart being shut down by Mr. Burns or something like that. That never happened.
There's only so many characters they could work into that 22 minutes. I'm sure they probably wrote something for Apu to be part of the whole thing.
They give an excuse that could cover anyone in town, but the ones they want you to think did it got actual lines in the episode, like Mo, Barney, Skinner, even Chalmers to an extent, but like they didn't want you to think Edna Krabappel did it, so they didn't give her a line. You know, they didn't want you to think Milhouse's father Kirk did it, they could have had a line where Kirk said he cost me my job at the saltine factory.
It was Miss Hoover from the Grassy Knoll, I think.
Nathalia says, you asked about the 1-800 number. I was 14 when this episode aired, and basically they would ask you to, before the call connected, say who you thought shot Mr. Burns. I'd called my grandma, and as I did regularly, and distinctively said Waylon Smithers into the phone. I also remember a weird website of some kind where they had the odds, and the two top guesses were Homer and Smithers. It was a special time.
Thank you so much. The one person who actually did this that listens to us, let us know, and that's great. And I wonder if anyone said Smingers did it. So this is a very visual thing, but we'll explain it. So Talbert Johnson says, listening to this episode got me to read the wiki page for it, which mentioned this moment when Homer is arriving to graffito tag Mr. Burns' office being a clue. So the image, this is me talking, Bob Mackey, the image is Homer getting the spray paint bag out of his trunk
after smashing through the security gate at the start.
Yes, and his head is blocking out the last two letters in the upside down word only. Mm-hmm. So there's a big no next to Homer's head for a few frames. So that has to be intentional.
And the arrow is pointing at Homer's head too.
That too. Yeah. So the arrow is pointing at his head and it's saying no. So that's just telling the audience for those few frames, it's not Homer. That is, that slipped by me too. It's so quick and that's so clever. I love it.
So many little things in this episode. I would bet they never worked harder on one episode than they did on this one.
They earned that showrunner status. Mm-hmm.
Kelly Eckhart says, at around the 8:18 mark in the actual episode, when Lisa says, I don't think anyone in this family is capable of attempted murder, Maggie, who had previously been asleep, opens her eyes and sits up at that exact moment. Such a great clue.
I missed that too.
Yeah, there's... Oh, goddamn.
Keep your eyes on Maggie in this episode, I swear. Last comment for Who Shot Mr. Burns Part 2, J.R. Rawls says, it is in no way, shape, or form a good and healthy relationship, but in terms of characterization, Mr. Burns and Smithers may have a semi-equal relationship in that Smithers obviously needs Mr. Burns on an important level as he falls completely apart without him. And that is completely true. I will say it is a unhealthy codependent relationship. Smithers needs to be there so Mr. Burns does not go off the deep end into cartoonish supervillainy, and Smithers needs Burns to reaffirm his self-worth.
Yes, if he doesn't have Burns in his life, he's like, well, then I'm nothing.
Yes.
And he just falls apart.
My only goal in life is to please an old man.
He needs to find a different thing to fill that void. And obviously, Malibu Stacy isn't enough.
Yes.
But he can't, without Burns there, I like that they have kept him as clearly a homosexual and not a Burnsosexual, as Al Jean had sometimes said. Like, at first, Al Jean saw him as a Burnsosexual, just like he said, if Burns is a frog, he'd love frogs.
Like, and then they wanted to be like, let's make gay jokes with him. We need a character to make gay jokes with.
They can't get enough. They're like, look, we've been doing them with Martin, but it's just not enough. We need we need an adult male to do gay jokes.
Adult gay jokes. So we have two really good comments for Xmas Story. These are the last comments we'll
do
today.
Our Futurama Holiday Special, which, again, we released like 2 days before the actual day of Xmas. Good times.
Feels like a million years ago now.
I know, right? Turd Samson says, there's another completely visual joke at the end of the episode that only works when you watch it live. When robot Santa Claus is flying around in New York, you can see the giant digital clock clock behind him, and the time is shown to be 8:57, which matches the actual real-world time you would have been watching a show if it had begun airing at 8:30.
That's really cool. I totally missed that, but that's great. That's when it actually had the good time slot.
Yeah.
For like 18 months, sorry.
I did have it in my notes. I forgot to mention
that. Okay.
Yeah, it was very neat that they had it match up with the time when they were finally at a good time slot instead of like 7:30 or not being aired.
Yeah, if that was a season 3 episode, the clock would have said delayed by football.
Goddamn football.
Yeah, and probably baseball too. All the sports ruin cartoons. So, last comment for today's show, Blue Chameleon says about Xmas Story. Bender is drinking liquor out of a four-dimensional Klein bottle on Christmas Eve, and they don't even draw attention to it. Like the 1729 reference, that sort of nerdy stuff woven into the fabric of Futurama is what makes it is what makes me love it so much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you so much, Blue Chameleon. You're right, yeah. And we're going to go nuts on this stuff when we do Talking Futurama. A lot of it's going to be like, well, the wiki says it's this, and I don't know what this is, but I'll just let you know for the sake of the podcast.
So that is, I think, going to be a challenge for me, but I'm up for the challenge of just like, I am a geek, but I am a English major geek who
Nerds are smart.
Who watched all cartoons and pop culture, and that's what I love about Simpsons. But I was not a math geek, and Futurama has, at the same time as being full of pop culture references, it is full of fucking math and science references. I'm like, God damn it, I don't know this shit.
I'm the same way, English major, master's in literature, but I know nothing about math or science.
I did awesome all the way to the end of algebra, and then when it came to geometry, they were like, no, you're not putting two numbers together. You're proofing stuff. I was like, well, fuck this.
Yeah, I thought I was good at math until high school geometry, and it was like, prove this is a triangle. And I was like, it looks like a triangle.
Yeah, it looks like a triangle.
What kind of game were you playing here?
I know. It hurt my brain. It's when I fell off and just like, all right, book learning for me, books for me, literature.
I had a memory in sophomore year that was geometry class. The teacher, no one understood proofs, so she gave up on us.
Wow.
And we didn't have to learn them. And maybe she shouldn't have done that, but I enjoyed it. So, you know. So
I mean, what are you going to use geometry for in your regular life? If you're going to end up being a scientist, then you probably would have stuck with it and you'd be like, oh, I love it. But otherwise, if you're a kid who's just like, this geometry is bullshit, like I mean, that's why they created classes like math for arts and language majors. Like, it's like, look, it's the easy math,
just the general classes.
This will get you your score. All right,
so thanks for listening, folks. We got a lot of great stuff coming up. Thanks for sticking with us. This has been an amazing month. We have a lot of new fans. I don't want to say why we have a lot of new fans, but if you're with us, it's all good. These are not bad reasons. It's all good.
All great reasons.
Something happened that really put our name out there and got a lot of new people interested in us, and we're very thankful for all the new fans and thankful for all the new patrons. So thanks so much, folks.
I mean, if you're a new patron and you want to comment on this episode, I would love to see if like what brought you to us. If you're one of our 100+ new patrons in this month, so. And I just also, one last time, thanks to everybody who is still supporting us, all the new people and the old folks who have been with us since we launched back in June. We finally hit that the goal to start a new podcast. It's going to be more work, but I want to do that work. I love podcasting, and I appreciate you folks loving us doing these podcasts and supporting us doing it. So thank you.
Yes, thank you so much. Look forward next week to the Dana Gould live show, and we'll see you next month for another episode of Talk to the Audience. See you then.